but that's the old me.
Shouting out on my windows rolled down, 'cause I don't care anymore, said I don't care.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great Saturday, and hope we can make it just a little bit better by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. Joining me to do so, as he does so very often on this show, please welcome from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube, Jeremy Branch.
Hello, glad to be here. I've been told that I love to hear myself talk, so let's see if I can make it through this whole episode without saying anything.
Yeah, that would be bad. Don't do that.
Okay, my bad.
Don't do that, because then it's just an hour of me talking to myself. And if I wanted to do that, you wouldn't be here.
That's a fair point.
How you doing, Jeremy?
Yeah, I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. We're getting closer and closer to the end of the year. So here, before too long, we're going to start looking back at the year of 2023. But before we get there, we've still got some stuff that we need to catch up on and discuss. Before we do get started, let me ask you a question in regards to James Gunn.
Okay.
Have you heard that recently he was doing an interview and made the comment that he believed that forcing cameos are like a real issue in the comic book movie genre?
Right.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, I heard that. I didn't see the whole like thing where he talked about, but I've read a few articles where he's quoted about that.
So how do you feel? Is he right? Is he wrong? What do you think?
I mean, I think we all like that little hit of adrenaline we get from that. So I'm not going to just totally say this sucks and they shouldn't do it, but he's not wrong either. I mean, it is. That's what it is. It's just a little bit of titillation. Yeah, when it's done gratuitously, when it's not done organically as part of the story. And I will say, you know, people, I've seen some people say, oh, well, he should talk. Well, tell me where he's done that. The only place that I can think of that he's done that is Howard the Duck showing up at the end of the first Guardians movie. But then he continued to put him in that world. So
is it fair to say that, and I mean, he was way bigger than a cameo, so probably not, but Adam Warlock?
No. Adam Warlock was not a cameo. That was, you know, that was bringing in that character and building that world. I don't think he's generally done that. I don't think he's thrown somebody in there just to throw them in there. I mean, there, you could make the argument for Howard the Duck. But I think that his continued use of Howard the Duck in that world kind of throws that argument out the door. Not that he was ever used in a big way, but he was there. He was part of that world. You could maybe make that argument for in the film, they were presented as the original Ravagers, but the characters in the comics, for the most part, were actually the original Guardians of the Galaxy. That, you know, had that bit where they all kind of showed up at the end of Guardians 2. But we've seen some of those characters again, and it was kind of like a bigger world kind of thing, and that was part of the world of the Guardians of the Galaxy and the Ravagers and all of that. So I kind of felt like that worked too. We did see some of those characters back in Guardians 3. No, we didn't see Michelle Yeoh back as Alita, and we didn't see Ving Rhames back as Charlie 27. Would have been welcome to see both of those, but of course Michelle Yeoh ended up taking another role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe too, so that gets a little dicey. I just don't see Gunn as somebody who has done that as much as a lot of other directors and overall universe type stuff has done that. I mean, you can really point at Marvel for a lot of that. And in fairness, Marvel does usually eventually pay off on those things, but sometimes it takes a long damn time.
Well, you know, I feel like it's painting with really broad strokes to be like, you can't do it because it's inherently bad. Because the cameos of the Justice League at the beginning of The Flash were fantastic, where Sick and Harry styles in as, I don't know, Star Fox or whatever his name was.
Yeah, Star
at the
Fox.
End of Eternals. That was stupid.
Unless they're going to plan on bringing him back and paying that off, which I think originally was the plan until Eternals didn't do that well.
Yeah,
whether it happens
yeah.
now or not, maybe another story. And I think that's kind of the same thing with a lot of the cameos you might think of in the DC films. You know, DC is kind of at this point infamous for setting up stuff in post-credit scenes that never pays off. And it's because it's because things just went nuts over there. Yeah, I want to say there have been 5 or 6 movies from DC post-credit scenes that never paid off. We're getting to that point. We're getting to that point with Marvel too. But with Marvel, I think there's still a feeling where they might pay off. DC, we all know that after Aquaman and the Kingdom of the Crystal Sun comes out next week, or whatever the heck the movie's called. I keep forgetting the name of this movie. Aquaman and the 7 Kingdoms or whatever it's called. Aquaman 2. We know that we've got a reboot coming after that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't even know if they're going to bother doing any post-credit scenes after that. If they do, I hope they're just to set up the whole reboot of it all. But we've had, you know, the post-credit scenes in both Shazam movies have never paid off and probably never will at this point. Certainly the post-credit scene in Justice League didn't pay off. The post-credit scenes in The Flash.
What about the Blue Beetle movie?
Blue Beetle, I am hopeful that we might get a payoff on. Because James Gunn has said that Zola Maragoina is going to stay in the new DC universe as Blue Beetle. I don't know that we're going to get a Blue Beetle 2. Although I got to be honest with you, I'm kind of more hopeful for that by the day, because I am just seeing more and more people starting to go online and saying, hey, I finally checked out Blue Beetle and it was a lot of fun. And
well, hey, I'm one of those people.
Yeah. I mean, it's been on Max for about a month now. I every time I open the Max app, it's still sitting there in like the top 5 movies on Max right now. So people are checking, people are finding this movie. They're checking it out in a way to do in theaters. So, you know, hopefully there's going to be enough interest there that maybe we will see a Blue Beetle too. If not, we're going to see that character somewhere in James Gunn's DC universe. So I am hopeful that that means that we're going to see that post-credit scene pay off, because that post-credit scene sets up a great character who's mentioned throughout that movie, Ted Kord, the second Blue Beetle. Spoiler alert, you know, the voice that you hear as Ted Kord is Jason Sudeikis.
Would love to see him
playing that role. And James Gunn is a big fan of the era of the comics in which that character was very prominent, and is using a lot of other characters that have been tied to that character. He's doing a Booster Gold series, which Booster Gold and the Ted Kord Blue Beetle were best friends. He is introducing Guy Gardner in Superman Legacy. Gardner was a member of the Justice League alongside that Blue Beetle and that Booster Gold. And he just cast his brother, John Gunn, as Maxwell Lord, who is, again, very much tied to that era of comics. So I kind of feel like maybe that one might get a payoff. I'm hopeful. But you said you saw the movie and liked it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I spoke with you when you went and saw it in the theater, and we even discussed it for a moment on Let's Go Pensacola a couple of months back, because of the track record of the recent Warner Brothers films. Maybe I wasn't as excited to run out and see it. And a lot of the feedback was essentially, it's good, but it's not exactly changing the game. It feels a lot like things that we've seen before.
Yeah,
and
that's
I feel
not
like
unreasonable.
That's fair.
That's,
I also feel like the characters were written in such a way, and there's this nice little cultural specificity that made it super watchable and enjoyable.
Yeah, I kind of enjoy another level too, being, you know, of Hispanic origin myself, although not the same origin as those characters. So there were some cultural things in there that I really got a kick out of. We do have to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Doctor Who, hey, the TARDIS, Doctor Who, hey,
Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And as you could probably tell by that music, it's time to talk about Star Trek. No.
Oh, fantastic.
No, I'm kidding. We are, of course, going to talk about Doctor Who. Play a little bit of the Time Lords and Doctor and the TARDIS, which is just one of my favorite things. But Doctor Who is one of my favorite things, and I am making the full court press here to convert Jeremy. 60 years on, Jeremy is finally watching Doctor Who for the very first time.
Woo-hoo!
So you're coming on board with these three new 60th anniversary specials that have just come out over the past 3 weeks that are on the new home of Doctor Who throughout the world outside of the UK, Disney Plus. Of course, in the UK, it's still... on the BBC. It's still Doctor Who is still owned by the BBC, created by the BBC, run by the BBC, currently being run by Russell T. Davis, who ran the show when it was revived in 2009. And his production company is named Bad Wolf Productions, which is derived from something he came up with while he was on Doctor Who the first time. But they have signed a worldwide agreement with Disney Plus to stream the show in the rest of the world outside of the UK. That's come with some extra money, and it's kind of increased the budget for Doctor Who quite a bit, and it's increasing the exposure of this this venerable sci-fi classic series that's been going on for 60 years now. And one of the new people exposed to this series in this time period is our own friend Jeremy Branch. So, Jeremy, before we get into any kind of details at all, what did you think about your first Doctor Who experience?
Okay, so I've watched the first season of the relaunch. It's been many years since Chris Eccleston was the Doctor, but I did watch that season.
Oh, I didn't realize. Okay.
And so I did, but let's pretty much take that off the table, because this has got such a storied history. I mean, that was just the beginning of a new era of Doctor Who. This is a BBC series that ran for forever. So, all that taken into consideration, here I am coming to the party 60 years late and with not a whole lot of context. There were these three different specials, and you are just a super fan, so I at least wanted to give it a shot, be able to give you my honest perspective, and I'm a fan. It's quirky, and there are things that didn't necessarily resonate with me in the way that they would with a lifelong fan. I started out less enthusiastic with episode one, and by the end of episode three, I think even just those three specials have a pretty strong arc, and I found myself super invested in all the characters by the time it was said and done. I made an observation, and I'm curious to know if you think I'm off touch with this.
Okay.
So, episode one, to me, feels like where Doctor Who started in that first, and when I say first run, I mean like the classic era of Doctor Who, I feel like the second episode kind of more embodies what, from Chris Eccleston all the way through David Tennant, kind of involves. And then I feel like, and this is the oversimplification, because there's obviously a lot of overlap here, but I feel like episode three is really tackling like current modern themes and is giving us an idea about what the future of the franchise would be. Do you think that's like kind of, does that feel right to you?
Well, I mean, I do think there's something to that. That's an interesting observation. Well, first of all, the first special, The Star Beast, which was the first one that we saw back, and it was the first one with David Tennant, now is the 14th Doctor. He was originally the 10th Doctor, and that's part of the storyline here, is that the Doctor is supposed to regenerate into a new body with a new face every time the Doctor dies. And I'm using gender non-specific pronouns here because the Doctor has been female before. In fact, just previously to this Doctor, the Doctor was Jodie Whittaker, so the Doctor was just previously female. And it was this big surprise that Jodie Whittaker regenerated into David Tennant, and nobody really knew what was going on. The first story that they've chosen to tell with this Doctor was adapted for a story that was done for there's a long-running Doctor Who comic strip in Doctor Who magazine. And that story, The Star Beast, was originally done as a comic strip during the run of Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor, who is probably, especially outside of the U.S., but even within the U.S., is probably the most iconic Doctor, certainly of the classic era.
Okay.
He's the one that had the big curly hair and the big long scarf, the big long multicolored scarf. And you still see, like, if the Doctor shows up on, like, The Simpsons, it's usually that Doctor. You know, I think, you know, American audiences definitely kind of fell in love with David Tennant and Matt Smith, but Tom Baker's still kind of the icon in a lot of ways. So that was originally a story done with Tom Baker's Doctor in the pages of Doctor Who magazine that Russell Davis then adapted and modified and used for this Doctor. So that's kind of very perceptive on your part to make that connection there, because it is kind of, in some ways, although it's got, you know, some more modern elements, and it's got the element of bringing Donna Noble back in and her family in and all of that. The story at its core is something that was written and drawn in, the late 70s or early 80s.
Nailed it so far. Heck yeah, dude. Love to hear it.
The second episode, I do think in a lot of ways can be compared to a lot of the classic episodes of Russell Davis's era when he originally brought Doctor Who back in 2009. I've seen a lot of people comparing it to the episode Midnight, which was a David Tennant and Catherine Tate episode.
Okay.
I definitely think this one goes in its own direction, and I think it introduces a lot of interesting concepts. And had some of the most truly creepy nightmare fuel in Doctor Who history, which is saying something, because this is a series that has a reputation for making kids hide behind the couch. So, you know, Doctor Who is supposed to be kind of scary and exciting at the same time as being, you know, these big science fiction and fantasy worlds and all of that. There's definitely elements of horror in Doctor Who, and I think they're definitely conveyed in this one. And I think you get some in the third episode as well. The giggle, I do feel like that's very much where we're going. And there were some elements in that episode that definitely are reminders of some things that are from the past. First of all, the Toy Maker is a villain that goes back to the original first Doctor, William Hartnell, who we have not
seen. Shout out to Neil Patrick Harris, by the way. He is just a gem of an actor. He is having so much fun as the Toy Maker.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I loved him in the role, but interestingly enough, the character was originally played in the 1960s by Michael Goff, who American audiences probably know best as Alfred to Michael Keaton's Batman.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, again, that character goes back to, you know, the very genesis of the series.
Interesting.
You have some other, you know, concepts in there that have been, you know, things that have gone along the course of the series, but then you have, of course, a big change to the way the series progresses which we'll probably get into in just a moment. And just, you know, some new things that are thrown in there. And, of course, the introduction of the 15th Doctor, played by Shuti Gatwa, who is the Doctor we will be following when the series resumes on Christmas Day with a Christmas special. So, I think that's very perceptive. Did you feel like you had trouble following things?
I wouldn't say that. There's just expositional moments in it that are really speaking directly to the fandom, in a way that those moments, I just kind of accepted them in the context in which they worked in this particular story, but I feel like with a deeper connection to the stuff that maybe it would have felt more substantial. And I feel like this is just kind of becoming the way of fandom where there are strings attached. And in order to get the most out of these experiences, Disney, I'm looking at you, then you have to be very, very invested in each of these things. And I don't know, despite having really enjoyed these and despite watching, I will watch the Christmas special, I don't know that I'm going to go back and start digging into the archives and go back to the beginning, you know?
And that's okay. I mean, it's almost an impossibility to go back all the way to the beginning because, first of all, there are episodes that have been lost.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there are episodes of the First and Second Doctor that just do not, that we know of, exist in any form to watch.
Interesting.
And they have been, over the course of the years, trying to recreate some of those episodes in animation and things like that. But there are holes in Doctor Who's history. I think anywhere you come in, you're going to be kind of diving in the deep end to some extent. You could very well, if you so chose to, start with the very first episode of Doctor Who and watch as much as you can all the way through. But I don't think that's necessary. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I've seen every episode, and I'd consider myself a major fan. I know I haven't seen every episode, and I'm not even close to having seen every episode. So you do kind of dive into a deep end at some
point.
Yeah.
What was the lapse? Like, when did they end prior to that?
The late 80s or early 90s.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there was an ending in 89, and then there was an attempt to revive it in around 96 with a TV movie that was not successful, and then 2009 is when it came back more or less for good. We'll continue this in a moment. We've got to be... take a break. We'll be listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And Jeremy, does that make you want to get up and dance around and throw a lot of rose petals around?
I got to tell you, I have not been so excited to hear a Spice Girl song since 1997, we'll say. I'm not sure of the date of that, but it's been a while.
Yeah, so that song "Spice Up Your Life" was used in the third of the three 60th anniversary Doctor Who specials that have run recently on Disney Plus. You can still catch those on Disney Plus if you haven't had a chance to see them yet. And it was a big dance number featuring Neil Patrick Harris, because it's Neil Patrick Harris. So why would you not have a big dance number?
He's phenomenal. I know I said that before last break, but it just he made that episode so much fun, and he is just hamming it up in the best way possible. Absolutely love that guy.
Yeah, I just think that he was great casting for what Russell Davis wanted to do with that character, and I think mm-hmm. it really worked. He played a character known as the Toy Maker, or the Celestial Toy Maker, who is all about games and all about, you know, everything about him is play. So, you know, it really worked for him, and he makes this grand entry into this in the world of Doctor Who. There's an organization called UNIT, which is a task force that deals with aliens and invasions and things like that. And he just bursts into their control room doing this big dance and lip sync number to the Spice Girls' Spice Up Your Life and just messing with everybody. And it's both entertaining and horrifying at the same time. It is.
Can I ask you, though, and I just made an offhand comment, but I think we got to hone in on this for a second.
Okay.
That is the same 3D model from Avengers, right? Like, that is Avengers Tower.
I don't think it's exactly, but I mean, obviously it's definitely inspired by, let's put it that way.
We see you, Disney.
This UNIT headquarters is brand new. This is the first time we've seen it in Doctor Who, and it was the previous UNIT headquarters was destroyed towards the end of Jodie Whittaker's run. So there was a reason to build a new UNIT headquarters. There's a lot of stuff going on in Doctor Who right now that is kind of taking the Marvel Cinematic Universe as inspiration in some ways. They are now calling it the Whoniverse. There are going to be spinoff series. There have been spinoff series in the past as well, but there's a plan for there to be more Doctor Who related content and building kind of a universe around Doctor Who, which I'm all for. There's so much history here, and there's so many great characters here, and we got to see a little bit of that in this episode as well, with Bonnie Langford coming back as Mel Bush, who was a companion of the sixth and seventh Doctors, getting to see her in this episode, and she is confirmed to be appearing in the new season that's getting ready to be starting up. I think we're going to see more characters like that crop up from the past, which is not something we've seen a ton of so far. So I'm excited about that possibility, and I think we're going to see some more spinoffs. I have a feeling we're going to see a UNIT spinoff, which would be a lot of fun. I'm here for that. And
what was the name of the first spinoff?
Big
spinoff.
The very first. There were spinoffs during the classic era. There was a series centered around K-9, the robot dog. That did not do terribly well. There've been a couple things, but I think the ones that most people think of are the more modern ones, which were Torchwood, starred, of course, John Barrowman as Captain Jack Harkness, and really kind of took him off in his own. And that series was a bit more adult than Doctor Who. It had some more adult overtones and things like that. And then there was the Sarah Jane Adventures, which centered on Elizabeth Sladen's character, Sarah Jane Smith, who had been a companion of the third and fourth Doctors, who came back during David Tennant's initial run and then spun off into her own series. It was a lot more kid-oriented. That one,
interesting.
Yeah, that one had a more youthful vibe. Those were the two big ones. There was one a few years ago called Class that only ran for one season. That took place at the Coal Hill School, which was the school that we initially saw going all the way back to the origination of Doctor Who. But we'd see that school crop up again. Clara, who was a companion of the 11th and 12th Doctors, was a teacher there for part of her time as well. So, there have been a few over the years. There's definitely room.
Torchwood was the one I was thinking about, and I remember John Barrowman being the star of that one. There's a couple big things that happen. Like you said, maybe they're taking cues from Marvel, but I think one of the big noteworthy things, and probably more so to you, is the fact that in addition to having a new Doctor, the 14th Doctor slash the Tenth Doctor sticks around at the end of this. What do you think about that in principle and concept?
Yeah, so that's the big buzz here. In the past, every time the Doctor has died, they've died and regenerated into a new Doctor. This time something happened that they're calling bi-generation, and basically they kind of yank on the Doctor's arms and another Doctor pops out. And so we have Shurigatwa's character, Doctor, the 15th Doctor, and we get to see him for about half of the last episode and get to see him interact with the David Tennant Doctor and get kind of a preview of what he's going to be like as the Doctor. I really loved it. I think it's great that, you know, we're going to get a chance for David Tennant's Doctor to have like a proper retirement rather than just a death. And we'll see what happens. I don't know how that leaves the door open to him possibly coming back. Russell Davis has made some comments in a commentary on the episode that this actually rippled back through time, and it's now possible to bring all of the Doctors back in whatever way. And there have been some times where we've brought them back, and they always have to have some explanation for why the older Doctors look old now, because, you know, he's...
Sure.
So now they're, you know, the explanation is, well, this is the Doctor that rippled off from that bi-generation, and he's lived another, you know, 800 years or whatever it is. So, of course, he looks older than he did in 1984.
Right, right.
So I'm all for that. We had a, there is still some stuff being produced that is not going to Disney Plus, and that it's been a little bit of a challenge to see as an American fan because Disney Plus is now the home. So there were some short episodes done called Tales of the TARDIS that kind of looked at before we knew that this was what was going to happen, had a chance for some of the old Doctors to come back and reunite with their companions and kind of have a little chat. And Now we're aware that that's why they were able to do that. Why we were able to have, you know, a Sylvester McCoy or a Colin Baker who looks the age that they do now hanging around and interacting with a companion who looks the age they look now. So, I mean, it's a big change. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out forward. But I think the more important thing here is the future of the series with Shurigatwa. And I really, really enjoyed his version of the Doctor in this debut. It's like I said, usually when you have a regeneration, it happens at the end of the episode and you don't really see but a moment of them before it cuts, and then they come back in the lead when the series comes back. So this is the first time we see a Doctor is him interacting with another Doctor. But it's the first time we get to see like that much of a new Doctor in an episode before he goes off on his own.
He doesn't have a lot of time in the episode, but he made a very good impact to me just in the couple of, you know, maybe he's in 10 minutes at the end of the episode, maybe, you know, give or take a little bit. But I thought he was great. I don't have a real strong preference on what the Doctor's personality and the way that he acts is, but I'm a fan of this actor. I loved him in Sex Education, and to see how much charisma he's bringing to this role just in the amount of screen time that he has, I'm like, I can follow this guy moving forward.
Yeah, he was also one of the Kens in the biggest movie of the year, Barbie. So he's definitely an ascendant star. Every Doctor has a different personality, but they've still got to have a quality that makes them the Doctor. And I think that he has that. And I think that's good. That's the thing about Doctor Who, like above and beyond everything else, since regeneration was not something that was a concept when the series started. Regeneration was a desperation play when William Hartnell started getting too ill to play the role any longer. And they were trying to figure out how they were going to continue the show or if they were just going to end it. And they came up with this concept and they said, let's try it. And they did this regeneration and he became Patrick Troughton. And he was a different actor with a different personality, but he was still the Doctor. And it worked. And we've continued it ever since. And that's what's created the longevity of this series. But it's made one of the intrinsic parts of this series change. Change is always part of Doctor Who. It should be part of Doctor Who. Or Doctor Who is just going to stagnate. So I love where we're going with this. I love Shurigatwa. I cannot wait to see. I am going to be in front of my TV on Christmas Day checking out his first full episode, and I cannot wait. We do have to take a break. We're going to be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Okay, let's get down to it, boppers.
Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Denialist channel on YouTube. Jeremy, man, sometimes I think we might should change the theme song of the show to that song right there.
Pop, it's pretty appropriate. What is that?
That is Can You Dig It by Pop Will Eat Itself. It is absolutely appropriate to the kinds of things we talk about on this show.
I can dig it.
Just love that song, man. Can't get enough of it. I would have sat here and played the whole thing if I thought I could get away with it. But I felt like it was an appropriate discussion, appropriate song to lead into the discussion for the last part of the show here, because it is kind of about what people are digging right now. There's been some very interesting news that happened this week, and I think it's kind of happened as a result of the dueling Hollywood strikes that we've just gone through. For the first time in their history, Netflix has released viewing data. Never done it before. There'd always been like, oh, this has been a hit. This has been, you know, so many people watched it, blah, 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 blah. They actually released for the months of January to June 2023 the total number of viewing hours for basically everything on the network. That, like, you can go on Netflix's website right now and download literally a spreadsheet that tells you how many hours of everything on the service something was watched, and it's ranked. So, you know,
well, that sounds fun.
It's not just the series, but the movies and everything, whether it's a Netflix original or something that they license from something else. Like, I'm just like, just like right now, I've got it up in front of me, and I'm just kind of rolling through the list real quick, and, like, you know, down in the hundreds, I'm seeing, you know, seasons of Gilmore Girls listed. I'm seeing seasons of The Flash listed. Not just the originals, you know, seasons of The Walking Dead popping up in there, that sort of thing. Along with all of the original movies and all of the original series. So we now have, you know, at least for 6 months of this year, hard data on what was being watched during that 6 months. Now, it's interesting.
And why is this valuable? As you said, it has something to do with the writer's strike. Tell the folks at home why this is actually probably, essential to the process moving forward.
Well, it has to do with the new agreements on how royalties will be paid on streaming shows, where there, if there is a certain percentage of the streaming audience that watches the show within its first 90 days, I think it is, if I'm recalling correctly, there will be an additional premium paid to the writers and the actors, which is kind of makes up for the residuals that they've lost from the old TV model. So,
right. So
this is, you know, this is showing what's being viewed. What's really interesting to me though, is just looking at the top of this list, and okay, this is for the beginning of this year.
Hold up, so, just for fun. Mm-hmm. Let me guess, and let's see how many of the ones that I am assuming get tons of views are actually getting good views.
Okay.
Is the Great British Baking Show on there?
Not in the top 20 or so, no.
Son of a... All right, yeah. What else?
Okay, I want to stress, this is for January through June of 2023. So, like, I'm looking at this and I'm not seeing Stranger Things. It's because Stranger Things didn't have a new season in that time. So, yeah it's still got people going back and watching it or whatever, but it's not going to rank at the top because there was nothing new for people to watch in that time period. So it is kind of localized
to what came out in 2023.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's what I found interesting because I think you and I are pretty knowledgeable guys when it comes to entertainment. I think we, we really pay attention to the broad spectrum, even of maybe things that we don't necessarily watch ourselves, but we tend to be pretty aware of what's out there. I don't know about you, but I read the industry trades on a regular basis, pretty much every day. And
I let you tell me.
Yeah. Well, I was very surprised to see that the number two series in that time on Netflix is something called Ginny and Georgia, which I had literally
love that show.
I had literally never heard of it.
I've put it on before. It is about a young mother and her biracial daughter navigating the struggles of young adulthood or something like that.
Well, season two was the second most watched program in Netflix in that time period with more than 665 million viewing hours.
What?
Yeah, and season one also did rank within the top 10 also, so people were apparently going back and discovering that too. Literally had never heard of that show. So again, somebody like me who pays so much attention to have not even heard it just goes to show you how diversified the entertainment landscape has become. And how individualized it has become.
Isn't that a point? Yeah.
Something like that could not even be on the radar. The number one thing in that time was the first season of The Night Agent, which I had at least heard of, but I hadn't seen.
Not me.
Yeah, it's an action adventure series. Number three is a Korean series called The Glory. So there is a lot of international programming in here too, some of which has found an American audience and some of which hasn't.
So hit me with something I've heard of.
Yeah. Well, the you're going to have heard of the number four thing. I can tell you that for sure.
Okay, hit me.
That would be season one of Wednesday.
I've heard of it. Now I watched it. You and I both watched it.
Now, you may be asking, why didn't Wednesday rank higher? I thought that was one of the biggest hits of all time. Well, season one of Wednesday came out before that time period. So that was still people catching up on it versus the initial impact of this is out now and I have to watch it now. I guarantee you, if you go back and look at, if they were to release the numbers for June to December of 2022, that Wednesday was probably number one or number two.
Yeah, it would have had to be.
But this is like the hangover of people catching up with it. And even then, still 507, almost 508 million hours of viewing in that time period. So, it's just very interesting. Just rounding out the rest of the top 10, number five was Queen Charlotte, a Bridgerton story, which I think was just like a spin-off Bridgerton movie. So again, you don't have a season of the show in here because there wasn't one released in that time period. But next on the list is season four of the show You, which I know has a very big following. Next one is season three of something called La Reina del Sur, which is obviously Latin American, not released in the States, apparently. That's the highest ranking thing that was not released in the States. It is not available globally.
To your point, just how wide of a net Netflix is casting at this point, and that there's international audiences that we're not even tapped into.
Yeah, number eight is season three of something called Outer Banks, which I also hadn't heard of.
I'm familiar with that one.
Yeah, number nine being season one of Ginny and Georgia, as I mentioned. And number 10 being season one of a show called FUBAR.
What?
Yeah. And again, something I haven't seen. And then, interestingly enough, number 11 is the final season of the show Manifest, which Netflix picked up after NBC dumped it. So clearly there was an audience for Manifest, NBC, with 263 million viewing hours. People were watching Manifest. So maybe
what does this say about us that we don't know, but like we've heard of two of the top 10? Are we bad at our job?
Well, I'd heard of more of those. I'd heard of more of those than two, but I mean, like Jenny in Georgia was the big surprise to me. It's like, and it sounds like something that would kind of be up my alley. It sounds very Gilmore Girls-esque, and I'm a big Gilmore Girls fan.
Sure.
But yeah, hadn't seen it. Your top ranked movie other than that Bridgerton spinoff was a movie called The Mother, which is just a little bit further down the list. But I mean, some of the more buzzy stuff like Beef is way down the list. Some of the stuff that's had more,
that was so good.
The movie Extraction, which did come out before that, is kind of further down the list, but it's really interesting.
And it's got Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah, I think the other thing that this provides people is, some look at maybe when stuff gets canceled and everybody's like, Netflix just cancels everything. Kind of goes more into the decision making here. Now, we mentioned Stranger Things. Just want to point out that the highest ranking season of Stranger Things is season 4 in that time period, still had over 133 million viewing hours despite having been out for I think close to a year at that point. So, if you're wondering if there's still going to be an audience for Stranger Things when it comes back, yeah, there's still going to be an audience for Stranger Things when it comes back. There's no doubt of that whatsoever. But I just think this kind of thing is fascinating. It's the kind of thing we've really been missing from the streaming world is really, you see the buzz and the online discussion and things like that. And I think it happens in network TV to an extent too, where you don't ever hear people talking about the NCIS shows, but those are the most watched shows on broadcast television.
I would be really fascinated to do like some sort of cross-examination between social media impressions and use of hashtags versus the actual quantifiable numbers of streaming hours. I think that would be a cool little thought experiment.
Well, I can guarantee you the trades are in the progress of doing that right now, and we will see that within the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. I'm really interested to see what's going to come out of that kind of analysis. I think we are going to find the same kind of thing that we do find on broadcast TV, that there's a lot of people that aren't active on social media, but are active on watching their television programs. And they just very quietly build a huge audience. So when that information comes out, we will discuss it on this show. But we're out of time for this week. Until next week, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.